Jonathan Cowop.
BBC Radio York.
Now, you might think that the business of authors self-publishing books is something new, but as my next guests are going to explain, it's actually been something that's been going on for centuries. Patrick Wildgust is the curator of Shandy Hall in Coxwold here in North Yorkshire, where they're holding an exhibition called Do or DIY. It's a micro-history, apparently, of self-publishing by writers who later became famous. One of those was the great Laurence Sterne. He self-published his work, The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy, Gentleman, back in the 1700s. And with us as well this morning is Nick Thurston, who's the artist who has arranged it all. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Good morning.
Welcome to the studios. First of all, Patrick, tell me about the exhibition. Why stage it at Shandy Hall?
Well, it's an unusual exhibition because for once it's not in the gallery at Shandy Hall, it's in the gardens. And the sort of concept behind it was that it came from the Whitechapel Gallery, where Nick Thurston, Craig Dworkin and Simon Morris put on an exhibition which was basically a book, and the book was on the walls of the gallery. Well, this time the book has been transposed into the garden, so there's big boards throughout the gardens where you can read the book as you walk around it, as if it's been blown apart by the winds.
Right. And so you get to enjoy the garden and the literature.
Yes, you do. And people have said it's so nice you get into going to parts of the garden that you wouldn't otherwise go into because you're following a story, sort of. But also that it's an invasion of the garden in its own gentle way.
Nick, obviously this works for you because it's your idea. Yeah.
Well, it doesn't hurt that it's a beautiful garden.
Exactly, yes. I mean, the garden at Shandy Hall is quite famous. Explain the idea behind the exhibition. As Patrick said, it's transferred from London. Why bring it here to North Yorkshire?
Well, Shandy Hall is the former residence of the wonderful Laurence Sterne. He was the vicar over the road at the local church. And Sterne figures as a kind of jump-off point for this micro-history because, as you said, back in 1759, Sterne self-published the first two volumes in the original 9 full volumes of Tristram Shandy. And in the process of self-publishing, he managed to conceal the fact that he'd done it himself because he was scared that the London literary elite would turn their noses up at this kind of provincial product. So he doesn't mention anywhere on the colophon title page or anywhere that it's actually been published in York and printed by a friend. So this was a natural sort of jumping off point for this kind of history. And the history really looks at the English literary canon, the English language literary canon anyway, and tries to sort of prize out those persons who actually self-published either because they couldn't find a publisher or, and this is the bit that interests us more, because they wanted to. Basically, instead of handing over a set of decisions to editors and designers and marketeers, they wanted to take responsibility for the stages of publishing that normally happen after the manuscript's finished.
For those who don't know Tristram Shandy, it is not just a great work of literature, but it's also a great work of print, isn't it? It's an extraordinary thing to read because you don't get that far into it, Patrick, before you start to realise that he wanted to do some very weird things with what actually appears on the page. I mean, stuff that is way, way ahead of its time.
Yes, you're right. He's playing around with the idea of what a book is. Sterne designed the book. It's almost less a book and more an art object because he includes means of telling the story which aren't just based on words and aren't just based on sentences. They're based on asterisks representing words that only you can determine because it's your imagination that's creating the text. He also has the death of a major character, which is represented by a black page. But there's no explanation. There's just a black page. There are chapters which are missing. There are chapters which contain no plot at all, contain nothing. Because he's looking at the idea of how can you tell a story and keep the reader actively involved. 50% of the book is in the reader's imagination. And also surprising the reader. He said that he thought that if the reader knew what was going to come next, then he wouldn't continue, he'd tear out that page completely.
And it's wonderful stuff.
I mean,
it's so far ahead of its time. You know, people do things online these days and they think they're at the cutting edge. And here was someone doing it umpteen centuries ago. My favourite bit is isn't a great bit where Uncle Toby, who is constantly trying to regale everybody with his stories of what he did in the wars and trying to build bits of battlements and defences and things in the garden. Much to everybody's inconvenience. He waves his stick thus, and so you get a squiggly bit on the page. Is that right? My memory serving
you
right?
Yeah, your memory serves you very well. It's a representation of liberty.
Right.
It's done by Corporal Trim with Uncle Toby there.
Right.
To show what it's like to be free. And it's a flourish.
So you wiggle the stick and you actually get the shape of the way the stick was wiggled.
That's
on
right.
The page.
Exactly. And imagine, you know, it would be hard enough to convince a mainstream publisher in our post-postmodern age to do that now. But imagine trying to find a publisher to do that in the 1700s.
Yes.
I mean, you'd be bonkers, right? So, you know, the interesting thing about Stern was that he was willing to put it on the line. You know, he was willing to test the limits of what a book could be, willing to test the limits of what a narrative structure could, you know, condense as. And he took the risk and put it out there. And it was no surprise that people like Hogarth and stuff jumped to his support and later became allies.
Did he outrage people as well? Did the sort of, you know, the more conventional say, I don't believe that I'm seeing this kind of nonsense on the page?
He always has done. He still frustrates the contemporary reader sometimes, the reader that wants to have a beginning, a middle and an end and wants to go through a book in a traditional Western style. He causes frustration with those particular readers. Others think, crikey, this is good. I've never read anything like this before. Especially when it's 250 years old. Mm. That's the thing which is quite... It's not just because it's old. It's because what he's managed to embed in the book is this spirit of adventure and exploration. And that's to be commended in any age.
Did it cost him an awful lot to do it? Because, I mean, that's what puts... Well, up until now, that's what has put people off. You know, if you've had a book inside you and you felt, I want to retain control of the publishing of this book, or I can't find anybody else who's willing to do it, it's cost you an arm and a leg to do.
Well, it cost those persons who work with him a lot, I'm sure, emotionally as well as physically, the people who are trying to marble pages and tip them into individual books and things like that. But, you know, the interesting point that you made earlier about being in an internet age and things like this just shows how important it is to really develop a strong critical history of the lineage that's already there, right? So the precedents for thinking outside the traditional form of the Codex book, the precedents for thinking about narrative in really dynamic ways are there, and they're long-standing. They're there before Stern as well, right? So the important critical work that we're trying to do with this show and that Patrick does there at the museum is to really think backwards and forwards about the possibilities of writing now.
Yeah. Did it cost him a lot to publish it?
Financially, he borrowed £100 from a chap called William Hall, who lived outside Micklegate Bar.
Did he?
Yep.
That was a lot of money, wasn't it?
It was, but it's also not sure as to really the extent of what that first edition actually was. There's a lot of argument and discussion between Stern scholars about the order that the editions come in. Because when the first two volumes were published, they were sent to London. And they were sold in a bookshop by the bookseller and publisher who wouldn't publish the book. And yet he discovered that he'd got a hit on his hands because everybody wants to buy it. Well, it's just testing the market, really, isn't it? So if it's going to sell, I'll publish it, which it did. And so then Dodsley became the publisher.
Right.
And gave Stern an advance, which made him rich.
And he didn't bring, because the other week on the show we were looking at the first ever guidebook to York, the serious guidebook, Eber Arkham by Francis Drake.
Uh-huh.
Not that Francis Drake, another Francis Drake, who published this enormously thick work, which is quite beautiful. It's in Fairfax
House.
We
have a copy in our
collection. You've got one too.
We have a copy that Drake gave to the Archbishop of York. And it's signed by him inside. It's a beautiful copy. I used it as the centre for an exhibition a couple of years ago.
Well, this
is a wonderful book.
This is the very book that the Dean and Chapter of York at the time took against, because they didn't think, we were being told on the programme the other week by Peter Brown from the Civic Society, they didn't think that a common man, who not of the priesthood, should dare to write about York Minster because it was such a holy place. But the point of that book was that was done in a way that lots of books were done at the time. You wrote to lots of wealthy people, lots of landed gentry, and you did it by subscription, and they all threw 10 or 50 quid or guineas into the hat.
Which has just come back, hasn't
it? Yes,
Unbound.
Yeah.
The publishing house that had published Jonathan Meads, our next speaker, has done it by subscription, and it's a new way of doing the old way.
Am I allowed to reveal that you've actually brought in the first edition of Tristram Shandy to the studio?
I think you have.
I want you to get out of here, because that's quite valuable, isn't it?
It is.
We're going to send security guards out with you, so it's all right.
It's especially valuable because it was a donation.
Mm.
And it was a donation by a New York collector who, when he died, his widow said that he wanted to send the set, that's all 9 volumes, all first editions, to the collection at Shandy Hall. So we're deeply grateful to James Pollock for doing that. And it's beautifully bound set, as you can see.
It looks like it. I mean, apart from the fact that it's in wonderful old leather-bound covers and it's got all the gold tooling and everything and whatever, but the pages are so crisp. It looks like it was made yesterday, but was published in 1759.
It was.
It doesn't have his name on the front page.
No, and this was, you know, again, this was part of the process of concealment, really, right? You get nervous about this idea that, you know, self-publishing and vanity publishing share a kind of grey area. And there's still a lot of critical work to do there about distinguishing between the two. I think there are a lot of really interesting publishing houses, artists, writers all around the world who are doing that work. But it's important that shows like this happen in institutions like Shandy Hall because it drags it back into a historical conversation.
Yeah. And publishing is changing. I went online the other day because I was told how much a copy of Eber Arkham would set me back.
Oh, yes.
If I wanted to buy a copy, and it was about 4,000 quid for a fairly average copy, which I haven't got right now. Mm. But I went to do a search online and I was told that if I wanted a copy printed up for me, you know, on-demand publishing, it could be done for a few pounds. Yes. So the way publishing is happening is we've got so set into our ways of thinking a book is a book is a book. This is the start, really, or evidence of the fact that the way books are published has changed tremendously over the centuries.
Yes.
Changed tremendously. And in your historical example, there are a set of reasons why people didn't want this common man to write about something sacrosanct. There are other reasons, other institutional reasons like money, economies, jobs, that mainstream publishing doesn't want this kind of publishing to flourish.
Power, politics,
exactly,
and all the rest
exactly.
of it.
And also, as an author, how you want your book to appear. For example, you might see it in a particular way, but no, it has to go through the marketing department, has to have a pink cover, perhaps with a suitably appropriate weird, which doesn't represent your idea. So you have to give over. You have to relinquish your responsibility. It's a very interesting dialogue.
Gentlemen, how long is it? How long is the exhibition on for at
Shandy
Hall?
Well, the exhibition is booked in to be on until the end of August, but because it is in the gardens, then we'll probably extend it a bit because people like it. They love coming to see it.
Jonathan Cowab, BBC Radio York.